I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE, which voted this week, like most of the rest of the world, to combat the glorification of Nazism, neo-Nazism, and other practices that contribute to fueling contemporary forms of racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, and related intolerance. NATO nation leaders voted against combating Nazism as they armed this week's indiscriminate attacks on Gaza, Syria, and Lebanon. Yet some of them will still be permitted today at one of the biggest global events of the year, the G20 summit. This year, it's in South Africa on the world's poorest continent. But with no shows from the leaders of the world's largest economies, the USA's Trump, China's Xi, or Russia's Putin, is the summit symbolic of an earthquake in the global economic order? With global inequality soaring, the richest 10% of people now account for 74% of the world's wealth, according to the G20. Contributing factors include the IMF World Bank debt burden and NATO's forever wars. Someone who foresaw the Western economic crisis is Honorary Professor at University College London, Steve Keane, author of The New Economics, a manifesto. He joins me from Amsterdam in Holland. Steve, welcome back to Going Underground. Obviously, Trump probably not going to the G20 because of... Jeffrey Epstein, wars on Venezuela, wars on Iran, who knows?
Couldn't possibly be the reason.
What do you think the significance is of them not turning up, the big powers, the largest economies?
Yeah, in some ways the G20 is sliding into being a failed sideshow. All these things seem to follow this trajectory because they never solve the problems they come together to supposedly address, and after a while it becomes an embarrassment.
Of course, Steve, at all these sorts of big international conferences, there are all these NGOs, different organizations, and many of them, I presume, will be telling these G20 leaders that the current path of capitalism is going quite smoothly. Why do you think that the role of private debt, if anything, will be celebrated amongst these people as they advise world leaders from the G20 countries, rather than, as you would say, something to be incredibly worried about? Many of these people presumably have shares in, apart from U.S. Treasuries, they'll have shares maybe in the Big Seven on Wall Street.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the problems about our private debt situation. Of course, it's a problem for the relatively poor rather than the relatively obscenely rich, because what you get is the high level of private debt is what's causing economic stagnation over time. Private debt is what really weighs on people's desires to invest, people's desires to buy houses, and so on. So we're living at a high level of private debt than even during the Great Depression, and that's a major reason why demand is anemic, basically reliant upon government spending. And of course, the people who benefit from this are the ultra wealthy who own the shares in the banks, and they're profiting out of that the burden that's falling upon the bottom 80% of the population. And at the same time, these governments are all trying to reduce government debt, and that actually puts a further burden on the private sector. So ironically, what they think is making the economies work better, reducing government debt, actually makes the economy work less well and forces people into speculative bubbles like Bitcoin.
Yeah, well, crypto is another issue, of course. But ironically, I mean, at least you think that Trump sees, unlike other administrations, that economic policies should be tailored to those regions or countries. I mean, when he's not going to war with them, which is another element, because clearly Keynesian military spending is the big talk in Western Europe and the United States. Why don't we just talk about that? There's a solution: war, the mass murder of men, women, and children. Britain the other day talking about new arms factories. All across Western Europe, the talk is of that, and the big beautiful bill, massively subsidized. The big five arms companies in the United States. Won't that solve the private debt problem that you worry about?
This is the hilarious.
If we put morality to one side.
They all believe they can have a wall-led economy revival in the same way they believe they can have a foreign investment-led revival. And I amusingly went to the Web Summit last week in Portugal, and that's a huge conference, 80,000 people, all about the impact of the web on economic activity, of course. And there would have been 80, I guess, countries inside there, all trying to take foreign investment away from each other. Now, of course, the net sum of all that is zero. because if one company invests in your country rather than its host country, then it's going to have less investment, not more, unless it takes on more private debt. So all these things tend to be effectively zero-sum games. And I can't think of a greater zero-sum game than believing you're going to have a war-led recovery.
And as journalists cover breathlessly the change in interest rate from a central bank, you think none of them understand that it is a zero-sum game?
They don't seem to. Journalists reporting on the latest machinations of Reeves and Starmer, for example, and it's all about trying to attract foreign investment. That's in Britain. Where do they get it from? If you go to the conference like this, there's the UK trying to get it. There's Malta. The number of countries I saw was hilarious, fundamentally, because they're all trying to do the same thing. They said, we can't generate the investment spending in our own country, so let's try to take it from somebody else's. What they don't realize, and this is what it's so frustrating for me to watch, is that governments can create as much money as they feel willing to do, then they're not going into debt when they sell bonds in their own currency. So they're all kind of cut back on the one thing which they can do without taking spending away from each other. But at the same time, they're all trying to make more money by taking foreign investment away from each other and by bombing the hell out of each other. So you see them doing the one thing which they could actually do without treading on each other's toes is run a larger government deficits, because there's no way in which one government deficit causes another country to be either in deficit or surplus. They are independent. But foreign investment is taking money from one country to another. The war again. How do you increase economic activity for the planet by blowing parts of it up? There are elements of their thinking which are so short-sighted. It's just ludicrous to think that these are our leaders.
Yeah, but if you put aside the short-term thinking and realize that obviously democracies in Western Europe and many of the G20 countries work on a 5-year cycle or 4-year cycle. Can you not see why they will focus on massive government spending on the war, the proxy war in Russia through Ukraine? I mean, what have you made of how, I mean, if you ignore the hundreds of thousands of killed Ukrainian young men, do these financiers and finance ministers in G20 countries see it as a net positive that they have been killed?
In the circles in which they move, they would see it as a net positive because, of course, if governments are creating money to fight wars elsewhere in the world, then that is a net increase in total spending. And then the military companies, the weapons manufacturers, make a fortune out of that. And those are the circles in which politicians move. They basically listen to bankers and warmongers. And between the two, it means that they end up ignoring private debt and encouraging government money to be used to sponsor military campaigns. And it's, there's one of the classic cases where the mass of the population lose out, and some of them lose their lives as well, out of what the elite sees as a way of increasing its wealth and power.
And this year's G20 being on the continent of Africa makes one immediately think of the influence of the IMF and the World Bank and their policies over decades on that continent. How would you characterize them?
Yeah, they're destructive. I mean, I've literally had World Bank staff come to see me after they've retired and show me the spreadsheets that they take to these countries. And the entire process is trying to make sure the spreadsheet balances according to the principles of the IMF. That involves slashing government spending programs on the poor. So the IMF is actually contributing to the inequality that exists. And it's already the major destabilizing force in human society at the moment. And the naive neoclassical economic analysis that all these economists who work for the World Bank and the IMF have ends up amplifying the inequality caused by the market system itself. When they retire, they often end up being, they end up apologizing and confessing what they've done. They can finally see the damage they've done. But when they're employed, it seems to be the pressure of work. They just go ahead and they end up slashing government programs for the poor while they're in power and regretting it later on. Well, I think they should regret it while they're in power and do something about it.
And every few years, we have, as you say, there's a revolving door, and those that used to work there apologize for it in retirement. But they do say, oh, look, we were wrong about these structural adjustment programs. Just explain to us what a structural adjustment program is as part of the blackmail in order to receive the aid. Obviously, most of the aid at the moment from the IMF, actually, certainly in Western Europe, is clearly going to Zelensky in Ukraine. And, you know, there's coverage of the corruption in Ukraine everywhere. Ousting of mayor in Ukraine raises concerns. Even allies of Zelensky worry he's using wartime powers to tighten control. The IMF pouring billions into Ukraine, $14 billion for Kiev.
Yeah. I mean, the problem with all of our political systems, they're dominated by conventional economists who believe that government should balance the books. And when you take a look at how money is actually created, that is nonsense, because governments have to spend more than they take back in taxation to create fiat money. And we live in a mixed fiat credit system. So there's complete ignorance amongst economists about how governments create money. And then what they do, they're saying they're trying to get countries to balance their books. What that means, they reduce the amount of money they create, which ends up strangling the economy in many ways. One of the reasons that the IMF has the countries of Africa over a barrel in that sense is they need foreign exchange for some of the investments they're doing, and they borrow the American dollars from the IMF to do that. But that then lacks them into the same problem they've had for centuries, ever since colonialism destroyed that continent, that they have had their resources run down. They don't have the domestic capabilities they used to have. They have to import, and that then gets them trapped in exporting for the sake of financing their foreign debt. And that is a disastrous process. The Southeast Asians kicked the IMF out a long time ago, the 1997 Asian financial crisis, particularly Indonesia, but basically said they never want to see an IMF official ever again. So Asia learned how to break away. I think it's time Africa does the same thing.
And as for the dollar, though, this conference slightly different because, with respect to those ideas, because since 2022, the dollar has changed what it's seen as, arguably. What have you made of? At the moment, EU presses states on use of Russian assets, but of course we know that massive amount of dollars are being frozen by the European Union, and massive amount of sanctions being applied by the NATO nation powers. And tariffs, of course, have been introduced by Trump as a means of foreign power. Would you say today's G20 occurs at a time when the dollar is at not at a turning point, but still part of its long-term decline as a reserve currency?
I mean, we have to go back to the beginning of the whole system. And in Bretton Woods, Keynes put forward an extremely sensible program that would have not had a national currency for international trade. It would have been a unit of account called the bancor. And it was summed to zero. The idea was that if you ran a deficit, you would get a negative balance. The countries running a surplus have a positive balance. Keynes had penalties on both, trying to limit the scale of the differences that occurred, and the international currency was neutral. It wasn't controlled by any particular country. What we got instead was the American dollar, which is the domestic currency being used for international trade, and that perverts the entire system. But on top of that, of course, the Americans have weaponized the dollar. They've made access to SWIFT impossible for Iran at one time in the past. Now they're trying to screw Russia with controls on Russian oil sales and so on. They've weaponized the means of international commerce. So it's no wonder that countries which aren't quite so perverse are trying to build an alternative to it, and I certainly hope they do, because this was always going to fail, and we may be living through the period where the American dollar fails not as a domestic currency, but it fails to be an international currency. And frankly, I think it's high time that occurred.
Professor Steve Keen, I'll stop you there. Steve, you were talking about the end of dollar supremacy around the world. You mentioned energy there. How does Ukraine demonstrate the structural energy imbalances for Western Europe that have been intrinsic to the way they've run their economies because they're so reliant on Russia?
Yeah. I mean, the energy is the great blind spot of conventional economics. Energy and money, strangely enough, are the two major blind spots. They have theories of production which leave out the role of energy. Now, what has happened with the Ukraine crisis and Europe deliberately cutting itself from Russian oil, and then having to get, gas from America in the whole process, massively increasing their costs. It showed something that I made a little line, one line of saying about some time ago. Labor without energy is a corpse. Capital without energy is a sculpture. What we're seeing here is if you take energy away from an economy, then it can't produce output. And that's the Europeans have hoisted themselves on their own petard by agreeing to cut off the supply of energy they've been relying upon for decades, which is Russia, and then switch across to the Americans, who are charging them 2 and 3 times what they paid for the energy from the Russians in the first instance. So it's showing the things which mainstream economics don't understand are the things which are causing the global economy to be so chaotic these days.
So how is it a perfect storm with the fact that they've cut themselves off from Russian oil reserves? I'm thinking of Western Europe here. But at the same time, they do believe in this balancing of the books, economies as local grocery shop ideas, which means they're cutting on social welfare programs and pensions for their aging populations demographically.
Yeah, it's insane. Because the main people who suffer from this obsession that governments have from coming from a neoliberal attitude about the government spending, the people who suffer from that aren't the Rupert Murdochs of the world. They're the poor people. So when they shut down hospitals, when they don't give pensioners, as the UK did, funds for pay for oil during winter, it's not Rupert Murdoch who freezes, it's the poor. So this is actually exacerbating the inequality that the private sector has caused in the first instance. And I just despair of ever seeing any people sitting back and saying, what is the actual logic of government spending, of the production system? And let's fill in those blind spots and see what results we get out of it. And the result will be a complete change in policies. We'd focus upon the need to get energy, which is non-carbon based, up as soon as possible. We'd have government spending to create fiat money and to make sure that pensioners don't freeze. And that, of course, then benefits the companies which supply them with energy in the first place. So we're basically taking the global economy across at the knees and wondering why it can't walk as quickly as it did when it used to have knees.
Or specifically NATO nations. I mean, we mentioned BRICS earlier. What indicators should we be looking at for this burgeoning BRICS movement, which to many seems very slow, even though it speeded up and accelerated in 2022? Very slow at trying to create new forms of governance, new forms of transformational trade, and so on. I mean, I know gold prices have been rising a lot. There's been a slowing of U.S. Treasury purchasing. What exactly should we be looking for to see signs that the G20 is losing, the G7 certainly has lost control of the global economy?
Well, it gets more transactions occurring in currencies apart from the dollar. And, I did want to see the BRICS create an alternative payment system, because the American-based one is so badly designed and used in such a authoritarian way by the American government. So I just hope to see more commerce, first of all, denominated in other national currencies, like, the Russians using the ruble now for oil purchases, China doing as many purchases as can with the renminbi in Southeast Asia. I just hope at some point that they come together and create the sort of unbiased monetary system which Keynes first put forward. They can do it to some extent by having a basket of commodities and creating an alternative financial system for international trade. I've got a feeling that's the one thing you can say in favor of Trump. He's accelerated the desire to get that done.
Yeah, I mean, obviously he has bombed Iran, Yemen, he's threatening Venezuela and other countries, and presided over the Gaza genocide, the latter portions of it. But his lack of intervention, certainly in Africa, will that perhaps benefit this pro-BRICS movement and his policies of continued genocide Joe in uniting Russia and China? But there are still elements within U.S. private capital that can use the U.S. state to threaten countries wanting to do that. What do you desire?
But the thing is, in the past, that threat was backed up by having American manufacturing on the other side, and you needed American dollars to buy the American capital goods you needed to make up for your lack of productive capability. That's no longer the case. It's now China that's making the best capital equipment in the world. So in that some sense, that is weakening the power that America's had over the African continent, and I think it can't come soon enough.
So because of that, is that the reason we should expect more military force being used? It's no longer the IMF and World Bank being able to force structural adjustment to impoverish an economy in return for aid. It's actually, they only have military force, NATO countries, to promote.
One of the classic things is they've run down their own military capabilities as well as running everything else down. They don't have the military to back up their saber waving in the sense they used to have it. And I've seen even comments about one of the reasons that Trump didn't want to give a particular missile to the Ukrainians is the extent to which each missile destroys a large quantity of rare earths and can't be replaced because the rare earths come from, wait for it, China. So in some ways, what the West has done by neglecting its manufacturing capability and trying to exploit cheap labor in the first instance is they've undermined their capacity to use that big stick of the financial system. That only matters if they've got the other big stick of the manufacturing sectors, and they no longer have that. So in some ways, this is watching America shoot itself in the foot.
Well, unless they're idiots, which is possible, but you'd think all these corporations need customers and they don't want to impoverish everyone so they don't have any customers. Are you pointing then to the only option open to these Western elites being a war? They need desperately a war and massive reindustrialization. I heard Britain this week, talk about 6 new arms factories and similar announcements going across Western Europe, as well as in the United States. Do they desperately need a big war to pull themselves out of it, and are they expecting it? And you're looking at the policy changes and the way that they're making decisions. Is that what we're headed for as their only solution?
Well, probably because that's the only option they can think of. I mean, you don't get selected by to be running a major country these days because you're a brilliant human being. You get it because you're a narcissist. And we've got the classic narcissist in chief in charge of America right now. These people aren't making sensible decisions. They're certainly not making decisions where they understand the system they're actually managing. So from their point of view, yes, a war is the way to revive domestic manufacturing. But the real way to revive manufacturing is to do what China has been doing, which is build it up for your own people. Aim for having self-sufficiency in virtually
everything. Isn't that what Trump, Trump the benefit of the doubt, aside from the Western European leaders who talk about wanting more all the time.
Yeah.
Trump clearly talking about the need to bring back domestic manufacturing from overseas. So would you be celebrating that?
Yeah, he is. And that's an improvement. I mean, the one thing you can say in favor of Trump is his gut sensibilities are pretty reasonable. He doesn't fall for the free trade arguments that most of the other leaders of countries do fall for. He sees that manufacturing has been shifted offshore. He's feeling the pulse of working class Americans who've been lost their skilled jobs and are now working in jobs, pardon the French, in Walmart and things of that nature. And he's picking up on that sentiment. I don't expect him to do anything about it, but he's quite right. What has happened over the last 40 or 50 years is a deindustrialization, particularly of America, but also a large part of the OECD nations. And China has been focused upon industrialization and not making the mistake the Americans did of thinking they can replace manufacturing with the services sector, or the UK made that mistake. They're pushing self-sufficiency and industrial capability, and they're eclipsing the West. Now, Trump is aware of that. He's blaming China for that. It's actually American corporations that did that in the first instance because they saw a huge increase in profit if they got rid of their American employees and got the goods being produced by Chinese factories instead. And they willingly gave away 50% of the ownership of those companies to be able to screw the workers more. That is the attitude the West has towards the poor. One thing in favor of China, again, is that the Chinese people have got a very good capability to demonstrate and show when they're not happy. And that desire to keep the Chinese population in general happier than they ever were before is a major reason why China's continuing to industrialize and develop. They're not making the mistake of letting a white collar elite take over the societies, which has happened in the West.
Just finally, you are speaking to me from Western Europe, and they'll be represented at the G20 in Johannesburg. What do you expect to be the impact of Western Europe losing this war on Russia through Ukraine? When it's lost, what's going to happen to Western Europe?
Oh, that's obviously, I'm not going to be able to pontificate better than any other people on this front. I think it'll be a huge shock to Europe, because it hasn't lost a war in that sense before, and America's lost plenty.
But it lost them in Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya.
The Americans led them in each of those cases. This is one where the origination was the European alone. I think they'll get a hell of a shock, because their attitude has always been that Ukraine can win this war. It's fairly obvious that a war of attrition can't be won by the smaller party, and the Russians will ultimately win that war, and then Europe will find itself having to confront a beast they thought they were going to kill. They've actually enhanced that beast.
But a need for the resumption of Russian energy as well.
Yeah. And they don't have energy sources domestically. The foolish decision the Germans made to shut down their nuclear power stations and reopen coal is absolutely stupid in every possible sense of the world. At the moment, with both global warming and the lack of resources domestically, so Europe has really turned itself into a center of stagnation. And the irony is that Europe was formed with what's called the Growth and Stability Pact. That's the formal name of the Maastricht Treaty. It's actually led to stagnation and instability. So this has been a long time coming, but it's comeuppance for designing a system which is based on a false concept of how a monetary and production system actually works. So it's been a long time coming, but they've managed to, again, shoot themselves in the foot, and they're a far less powerful country than they were, continent than they were before they tried to come together and form the European Union. And it's watching children fall apart is in many ways my feeling about it. This is always going to happen. It just seems to be happening now. But 30-something years ago, Wynne Godley said that the European Union and the Maastricht Treaty was a suicide pact for Europe. We're now seeing the results of that suicide pact.
Professor Steve Keen, thank you.